Welcome in to White Sox Weekly here on the ESPN 1000 Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network. I am Connor McKnight. White Sox and Marlins coming up later this afternoon. A 3-10 start for the two teams. Garrett Crochet gets the ball for the White Sox, so you are going to want to make your plans to be with us. Crochet has been excellent. Maybe the best starter in baseball since May 1st. And if he's not, he's certainly in the team photo for one of the best starters in the game. It has been incredible to watch Garrett Crochet's production this season. That conversation does not come without trade conversation. We know that. That's been a big focal point on the show here over the last couple of weeks. And we will get right back into some of those trade talks as we go throughout the afternoon. Our pregame show's at 2:30. We're going to hear from Michael Huff, the director of youth baseball with the Chicago White Sox. He is also a college baseball analyst on the Big Ten Network. And as we get closer and closer to draft night on July 14th, we figured what better time to talk to Mike about his appraisal of college baseball and kind of the draft targets the White Sox have set before them at the number 5 pick on Sunday night. We'll talk draft with Michael Huff coming up a little bit later in the show. Scott Merkin, who covers the team for MLB.com, will be our guest at 2 o'clock. He is live and on the scene in Miami. He spoke with Jake Berger yesterday. He watched the win, the whole deal. We'll talk to Merk in just a little bit here on the show at 2 o'clock. Scott Merkin of MLB.com. You are also going to hear some fun stuff from the minor leagues today. Colson Montgomery named to the Futures team. He and Noah Schultz will both play in the Futures game during the All-Star weekend, starting on Sunday night and running all the way through until the 16th when the All-Star game is scheduled to take place. I think you're going to be really interested in some of the stuff that Colson had to say about his selection to the Futures game, what it meant to him, but maybe even more importantly, kind of the developments he's made at AAA this season that are a bit under the hood. It's not been a ringing success for Colson Montgomery at AAA this year, at least at the plate. But as he describes it, there's been a lot of steps made in the right direction here about the everyday of the game and what that's going to mean for him going forward as he tries to, you know, stick at shortstop and become that tentpole part of the White Sox organization, a power-hitting shortstop with athleticism and bat-to-ball ability and a good eye at the plate. All of that stuff in Montgomery's profile still, in his scouting report still, and we'll hear from him in a little bit too. We've seen some cool stuff down at the minor league level with the promotions of Edgar Caro and Brooks Baldwin to AAA. We'll get into what the future looks like for the White Sox, but first we'll start with what it looked like last night. White Sox beat the Marlins. It was it got a little hairy at times. 3-2 the final. White Sox won 10 hits. They left 11 on base and were 3-for-11 with runners in scoring position. Enough, but not a whole lot. The Marlins were also 3-for-11 with runners in scoring position. The White Sox, listen, Michael Kopech came out, got the last out of the eighth inning, issued a 4-pitch walk to the leadoff man in the ninth, Xavier Edwards. Run came around to score on a couple of hits. But after he lost command of the strike zone early on in that ninth, he was able to wrangle it back for himself, throw a couple of good fastballs, and got Josh Bell on a 3-run ground out to end the ball game and seal up his 8th save of the year and the White Sox 26th win on the season. They are now 26-64, having beaten the Marlins last night. And hopefully, I mean, as best you can, you try and eye these pitching matchups and give a team the advantage dependent on which starter you think has a better chance of mowing down the other lineup. And today, this afternoon, it is a decided advantage for the White Sox with Garrett Crochet going against the Marlins and Yanni Chirinos throwing for the Marlins and against the White Sox. But it's baseball, and you never know how things are going to go. The other thing from last night that I think is probably the headline of the ball game, if it's not, you know, that kind of that hairy ninth inning and Michael Kopech getting out of things, it was Drew Thorpe. Another start for the youngster. The 6 1/3, 1-run quality start outing for Thorpe now feels more like the norm than it does the exception, and that is a really good feeling. Broke into the league on June 11th, threw 5 innings of quality baseball against the Mariners, gave up just 1 earned run. 2 starts after that against the Tigers, 6 innings, no runs. Next start against the Rockies, 6 innings, 2 earned. And then last night against the Marlins, 6 1/3, 1 earned run. Obviously, there's the blow-up start in between there, right? His second big league start where he allows 7 earned in 3 1/3 against the Arizona Diamondbacks. And in that start, it was pretty clear that Thorpe did not have a command of the fastball. It just wasn't there for him. There was a lot over the plate, obviously. 6 hits, 7 earned, 5 walks. There was a lot outside the plate, 5 walks. He did not strike out a batter. He did get a few whiffs on a couple of different pitches. But with Drew Thorpe, what we're seeing here is pretty clearly the questions that many had about the profile to begin with. A guy with an okay fastball, both velocity-wise and spin-wise, but an exceptional command, control, and spin rate on a changeup that makes hitters go insane. And what we saw last night was a lot of good changeups away from the left-handers. What we saw last night was a lot of good fastballs away from the right-handers. And also what we saw last night was some good sequencing that helped him get in an advantageous count in more against more hitters than not. We saw the balance last night, too. More changeups than fastballs for Drew Thorpe in the ballgame. He threw 34 changeups, 24 fastballs. That, to me, 38% changeup, 25% fastball, you know, kind of in that range, that, to me, feels right for a Drew Thorpe kind of start where he, I don't know if cruising was the right word last night, but there were certainly moments in which it felt like he was on cruise control, had some good help from the defense later in the ballgame after Thorpe had left. You got a great catch from Luis Robert Jr. in right center field to leave the bases loaded for the Marlins. Otherwise, you know, that game really starts to turn on its head some, and the White Sox are reeling a little bit as the Marlins come back with a couple of big hits in that seventh inning, but fall just a little bit short again, thanks to the great glove of Luis Robert Jr. in center field. The other thing for Thorpe, too, we saw cutters and sliders last night, and those are kind of the it looks to be those are the two pitches that he's using to go away from right-handers some. But what he was also able to do is drop that slider low and in to left-handers and then follow that up with changeups or fastballs away. DJ pointed it out at a couple of points during last night's game. That sequencing, that mixing and matching there really kept guys off balance. I think of who was it? Jesus Sanchez, who's a right-hander, but still really chased him and looked befuddled in the 2 strikeouts he had against Thorpe last night. That those at-bats seemed to me to be the ones that Thorpe was maybe most in control of throughout the night, and it was just kind of, I don't know, nice to see him do that to a guy that's, you know, been there for a little while, understands what he's trying to look for at the plate, and he might have hurt himself a little bit too because he is not in the lineup for the Marlins today. We saw him kind of grab at a hamstring after a swing, and he left the game in the 8th for Emmanuel Rivera. Speaking of lineups, the White Sox lineup is out for the ballgame this afternoon. Give you the 1 through 9 here real quickly. Tommy Pham leads off. He's in right field. Andrew Benintendi is in left, and Luis Robert Jr. is in center field. Gavin Sheets has the designated hitter assignment today. Andrew Vaughn will play first base and bat 5. 6th hitter is Paul DeJong. 7, 8, and 9 for the White Sox are Lenin Sosa at third base. Nicky Lopez at second, who has found some raw doubles power here over the last couple of games. He laced one into left last night. 2 RBI doubles for Nicky Lopez, who, again, hitting really well. And then Corey Lee in the 9 spot and catching for the White Sox. He'll be the battery mate of one Garrett Crochet, who is probably making his second-to-last start before being named to the AL All-Star squad. More on that as we go throughout the afternoon here. You can join us at the ballpark on Friday, July 12th, for Margaritaville at the Park. Receive a limited edition Margaritaville-themed hat when you purchase a specially priced ticket. Be sure to stay after the game for a post-game fireworks show presented by the Village of Bedford Park. And to purchase tickets, visit whitesox.com/promos. Be a good time at the ballpark on July 12th. I think, for me, the things that are top of mind outside of the Major League trade deadline are things for the White Sox that we've been watching over the last month. It's Jonathan Cannon starts. It's Drew Thorpe starts. it's some of the young players who are producing a bit more than they had in earlier stints with the White Sox. I'm thinking of Lenin Sosa on his six-game hit streak, five in a row, not last night, but the five before that with multiple hits. And that's not to say that all of a sudden the scouting report on Lenin Sosa has changed to, you know, a first-division regular, but if Lenin Sosa is something more like a solid contributing bat off the bench who's got a defensive position or two at which he can remain above water or maybe even a little bit closer to plus, like at third base, then that makes to think starts to make you think a little bit differently about what the near-term future is for the White Sox. Nicky Lopez, a little bit of the same thing in that, you know, are you... Is he a viable candidate to be a veteran addition or a veteran a presence and a guy who can produce some into 2025 as opposed to holding down a place for someone to bump him off of that spot? And I think, you know, for a lot of the guys in this lineup right now, whether they are trade candidates like Tommy Pham or Paul DeJong or perhaps even Luis Robert Jr., though I put him in a very different category than the other two guys I just named, The question is, how much can you, if you aren't a trade candidate per se, how much can you keep the young kids at bay, right? Because the White Sox have just made some big moves in the minor leagues in promoting Brooks Baldwin, who is a do-everything infielder, played some short, played second base the other night at AAA Charlotte after getting promoted. He has played third base. He has run some in the outfield, though it has been much more infield work for Brooks Baldwin than it has been in the outfield. And Edgar Carroll, one of the top prospects in the system, was promoted from AA to AAA. And last night, you saw all three of them, Montgomery and Carroll and Baldwin, all went yard. And that's fun stuff. Sorry, that was two nights ago. But that's fun stuff. Last night, it was Dominic Fletcher who took off and homered in a right field. You like to see that young core coming together. You like to see the promotions based on production, based on readiness, based on merit, that kind of group these players together up and through the bigs. I know that White Sox fans have kind of done this and seen this before, but it is where the franchise is yet again. And the hope is, the expectation, maybe even a better way to put it, is that lessons have been learned from whatever process you'd like to, or whatever label you'd like to put on the process from last time around, and that even the young core, the minor leaguers, the guys in the system that exist right now, your Montgomerys and Schultz and Ramos and Caro and so forth and so on down the line, that they're going to be supplemented, if not pushed off the top spot of their own prospect rankings, by some of the trades that the White Sox seem poised to execute here in the next couple of weeks. And I guess that's the question that we've been asking for a while now is, what are you ready for, right? I mean, as a White Sox fan, as understanding that Garrett Crochet is one of the best starters in all of baseball, are you ready to see the White Sox trade him, or would you rather scream and yell and get on top of the table and demand they keep him? I can see it both ways. And I have a lot of smart baseball fans and analysts and pundits can argue it both ways. The same question goes for Luis Robert Jr. And you can answer those questions on your own. 312-332-3776. That's the phone number here on White Sox Weekly. When we come back, we'll get a little bit more into the pitching side of things. Drew Thorpe was great last night. I got some write-up stuff from a couple of different places about Garrett Crochet, about how the league seems to think about Garrett Crochet, and just kind of the success of the journey that he's been on here in the first half of the season as we get closer and closer to the All-Star break. You know this, right? I would imagine you're listening to the show. You have listened to and or watched just about every one of Garrett Crochet's starts this year. So you know just how good he's been and the improvements that he's made, the alterations he's gotten to kind of make to his arsenal. But I think we put it the way we're going to here in the following segment, it might open your eyes just even a little bit more as to the value and the talent that Garrett Crochet has in that left arm. 312-332-3776, that's the phone number. This is White Sox Weekly here on Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.
Cap'n! and Jay Hood. Monday morning at 7. ESPN Chicago.
Welcome back to White Sox Weekly here on the ESPN 1000 Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network. I'm Connor McKnight, and you can celebrate National Hot Dog Month by entering the Ultimate Fan Sweepstakes for your chance to create your own hot dog, presented by Vienna Beef. July's winner will work with the Chicago White Sox head chef to create and name their own hot dog that will be sold in stadium. Enter at whitesox.com/sweepstakes. I don't quite care what you put on your hot dog as long as you enjoy it, right? I mean, drink your drink, eat your hot dog, that kind of thing. But I do think you should name it the Darren Jackson. I think that should be the name of your hot dog entrant. That way, when your hot dog is sold at the ballpark, we can tell everyone to go get a Darren Jackson, and that's going to be fun. First, mostly, it's going to confuse the heck out of DJ. He's going to lose it. He's going to have no idea what's going on, and that will be entertaining. That's just my two cents on the Ultimate Fan Sweepstakes for your chance to create your own hot dog, presented by Vienna Beef. Again, whitesox.com/sweepstakes. Going to talk with Michael Huff, the White Sox, the director of youth baseball for the White Sox, coming up at 1:30. Scott Merkins, our guest at 2 o'clock. Plenty of time for you, 312-332-3776. That's the phone number here on White Sox Weekly. And I guess the overall question is, we're painting this in different shades. I get it over the last couple of weeks, but the biggest questions around this White Sox team over the last 3 to 5 weeks has been, who's getting traded? What will they be traded for? And I guess today, how much are you ready to see this roster change? You know, I think a lot of White Sox fans, at least those that I've heard from and talked with, are completely understanding. And, you know, if ready is not the right word, then it's got to be close to it. To have a trade of Tommy Pham, of a guy like Paul DeJong, to have a trade of, you know, bullpen pieces, whether that be a guy like Stephen Wilson or maybe even Michael Kopech to a certain degree. And all of those, Eric Fetty, I think a lot of people understand, is a guy that a lot of other teams would pay quite the premium for in terms of prospect value. And that's what the White Sox desire at this point in their, you know, kind of in their franchise, you know, window, wherever you'd like to put it. I think we use the word, as baseball fans, the last 15 years or so have been littered with the word rebuild for all sorts of different actual phases of team building throughout the game, right? I mean, you had your actual rebuilds. You know, you had your 2012 Cubs, you had your 2013 Astros, right? I mean, those were tear it down to the studs, manipulate some of the QO offers and all this other kind of stuff, and really, I mean, listen, the Astros tanked with TV ratings as well as they did in win-loss record stuff. I mean, that's how serious that was, and for quite some time. It felt for a little while there that they'd never get to where they did, consummated with the banging scheme and the cheating and the winning of the World Series and all of that stuff. But now, I think there are different, you know, places on the spectrum, I guess, of a rebuild at the MLB level. A lot of that has come because of a new CBA dictating what can and can't be done, how teams can recoup value from either trading players or having players sign free agent contracts in other spots, all this other stuff. You know, the draft rules have changed, the slot values have changed, the international signing rules have changed. A lot of stuff has either taken a total about face or certainly changed enough that it would be unrecognizable, I think, in a lot of places to those teams that did the quote-unquote hard rebuilds 15 years ago. Now we're in a different era where I think the expectation is, from fans at least, that you do kind of have to build the plane on the fly a little bit. While it's in the air, you should be constructing a winner. And I think that's where the White Sox have to prove that they can take that next step, if that's indeed where their aim is, right? It's, okay, the pieces that I've named for you, you know, everybody who may or may not be on the trade block here outside of Garrett Crochet and Luis Robert Jr. are pieces whom you could trade and still build the plane on the fly a little bit, right? And where it changes is talking about a trade of Garrett Crochet or a trade of Luis Robert Jr. Because those two are the most talented players on this team. They are the most impactful players on this team, even though Garrett Crochet is a one-every-five-day, one-every-six-day kind of guy and has some questions around him in terms of His availability, I don't want to say durability because that's a different question. His availability as it pertains to the end of this season or his ability to pitch late in the season for a contender if he is traded. Those are the questions around Crochet, and those questions really shouldn't be have to be asked when we get to 2025, which I think inflates the trade value right back up to the top for Garrett. I think when we start the 1 o'clock hour here, I've got some stuff that Mark Feinsand at MLB.com has written down, and some stuff that MLB Trade Rumors has kind of been tracking as it regards a few individual White Sox trade targets from other teams. Just saw on Twitter, and we'll bring this to you in the 1 o'clock hour as well, Ken Rosenthal was on Fox talking about the updated, you know, kind of contenders and what they're looking for, and he's got a big name team looking at a big name White Sox player. I think you can probably put those two together, but the White Sox played this team not too long ago, and the player is the guy who's pitching this afternoon for the Sox, and that's Garrett Crochet. So we'll bring you that on the other side of a break as well. But I think with Garrett, for me, I'm kind of two minds on this in terms of my own moral, no, not moral, in terms of my own baseball happiness, right? Because I said this about Dylan Cease, you know, as we were ending the season last year and kind of getting into spring training this season. I just really liked watching Dylan Cease pitch for the White Sox. It was fun more than anything else. And this game is supposed to be fun. It's a game. It's supposed to be fun. Watching Garrett Crochet pitch right now is as fun as it gets. You're watching that guy, that absolute stud, go to the post every 5 or 6 days for your team. And for the most part, you're watching him excel. Not to the point where just the numbers are great, but the dominance that he achieves during his start is breathtaking at times. And I even think that, you know, in a couple recently, there have been a few innings that have, you know, threatened to get away from him a little bit, or are at least gotten somewhat wonky, right? I think back to the second inning, his start against the Rockies, where there was a hit through the left side. White Sox had the, you know, quote-unquote shift on. You can't actually shift anymore, but the shift was on. He had the balk after an infield squibber by Elias Diaz, which moved a runner into home, scored a runner and moved another one up. Another infield hit by Michael Tolia that kind of snuck under the glove of Paul DeJong, a stolen base. Two runs in that inning on batted balls that I think the exit velocity of added up to like 150 with both of those batted balls, right? All three of them perhaps. And then the sacrifice fly scored two. And you thought, well, that was a lot of pitches. He had to work pretty hard. Comes out for the third inning at the top of the lineup. Even has to work around an error by Lenin Sosa there. Rolls two and has a very, very comfy rest of the ball game, including 11 strikeouts and no walks. Crochet's command of the strike zone has been exemplary all year long, and it is a big reason, maybe the biggest reason, outside of, you know, just pure stuff, I suppose, that he's been able to work through defensive mistakes behind him, his own, you know, kind of balk issue that popped up in that particular game. That just absolute pounding of the strike zone, that methodical strike one, strike two, getting ahead of hitters, makes him as dominant as anybody in this game right now, which has been stunning to watch. And obviously a different kind of conversation when it comes to what if the White Sox trade him in the next couple of weeks. Well, we'll get to some of those answers and some of those evaluations from smart folks who have kind of polled the league. We'll hear from Ken Rosenthal in a little bit here on White Sox Weekly as well. Plenty to do, and your phone calls too. 312-332-3776. That's the phone number, and we'll get you all set for the rest of the show. In just 10 seconds here, we'll pause it for station identification.
This is ESPN Chicago, home of the White Sox. WMVP WTBC HD2 Chicago, a Good Karma Brands radio station.
We'll turn this into Trade Rumor Central when we come back at the top of the hour. I'm Connor McKnight. It's the Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.
Recap the game, Cap and J-Hood, weekday mornings at 7.
Welcome back to White Sox Weekly here on the ESPN 1000 Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network. I'm Connor McKnight. Take advantage of one of our best offers this summer. Get one ticket and two beers to select games starting at $19 with Miller Lite Baseball and Brews. Must be 21 and over with a valid ID to purchase tickets. Visit whitesox.com/brews. Also, head to the ballpark next Saturday, July 13th. The White Sox take on the Pirates at 1:10, and the first 15,000 fans, 21 and older, will receive a throwback jersey vest presented by Vizzy Hard Seltzer. To purchase tickets, visit whitesox.com/promos. Garrett Crochet on the bump for the White Sox today, a 3:10 start against the Marlins. The White Sox won last night 3-2. It got dicey late. The White Sox dropped 2 of 3 against the Guardians, but the offense, exception last night, has clicked it into a bit of a different gear. It's been good to see. Would you like to see more? Yeah, absolutely. Hopefully they're able to do that in support of Garrett Crochet this afternoon. Now, we mentioned that, I mean, listen, this is, we are in prime trade deadline rumorville, right? I mean, this is July 6th. The deadline is the 30th. There are, you know, 20-something days left, not much time. The Brewers traded with the Rays and picked up starter Aaron Civale. And I saw a lot of think pieces the other day when this trade got made. Oh, this is going to jumpstart the market. Oh, this takes the Brewers out of the running for other starting pitching. It hasn't jumpstarted the market. We would be talking about actual trades instead of it did it jumpstart the market here on the show. And I don't think it took the Brewers out of hunting for maybe some more reasonable starting pitching. I guess, you know, whether it's a guy like Jack Flaherty from the Tigers or Garrett Crochet of the White Sox, the prices there are different. Flaherty's a pending free agent. Crochet, as you know, has this year and two more after that attached to his team control. But those are more, exorbitant spends, I think, from a prospect standpoint, and probably guys that would earn a little bit more if they wanted to keep them around. Then the Brewers might be willing to put on the payroll, but we'll see. I still don't think it takes them out of the running for a guy like Eric Fetty, perhaps, or some other starters that are out there too, the Brewers being on top of the NL Central and dealing with a host of starting pitching injuries, in case you're wondering why we're kind of hammering the Brewers a little bit here on our trade deadline central portion of the show. I was reading around in some couple of different places, and on MLB.com, it's got Mark Feinsand, great writer, it's a list of the 16, I think it was 16 players that are on the up as we get closer and closer to the deadline. You know, trade targets that have increased their value some. And he's got write-ups on three White Sox players, and we'll start with Garrett Crochet getting a write-up in this piece. Garrett Crochet, left-handed pitcher, White Sox, current Fangraphs wins above replacement 3.7. This was just, I think it was 2 days ago. Crochet, Feinsand writes, has been considered the crown jewel of this year's pitching market, having posted a 3.02 ERA over 100 and a third innings despite a rocky transition to the rotation. In 6 June starts, the 25-year-old pitched to a 1.91 earned run average, striking out 56 batters against only 6 walks in 37 and two-thirds innings. Crochet's earning $800,000 and has 2 more years of club control, though having already surpassed his innings total from his first 4 years as a professional combined, there are some questions about how he will handle the workload during the second half. He's got potential fits listed for each and every one of these trade targets, and we'll get to those in just a moment for the other two players, but for Crochet, they are listed as the Dodgers and the Orioles. Obviously. I mean, the Dodgers, of course. Those two teams are so deep in prospects, the Orioles maybe more so, they don't know if they're coming or going. The Dodgers would love to add another arm. They seem to have no care whatsoever, probably from in a good way, about the long-term health or maybe the variance involved in the pitching. Tyler Glasnow signed to a big-time contract after his career high in starts before signing with the Dodgers this offseason was something like 17, I think, in a season. Tons of stuff. He leads Major League Baseball in strikeouts. They are, the Dodgers, fearless when it comes to signing big-time pitching like that. I mean, they also signed Yoshinobu Yamamoto, who is currently on the IL right now, and they seem to have either the wherewithal or enough money or enough of a scouting eye that they like to go ahead and chase these kinds of players and sign them to contracts. Whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, I suppose, is up to you. But the results kind of speak for themselves. They're dealing with it one way or the other. Now, the other thing that I thought was interesting here, too, and it kind of helps, we talked about this earlier on the show, chronicling the evolution of Garrett Crochet, I think, is kind of important here, especially when it comes to, are we talking about a trade in the next couple of weeks? Or are we talking about something a little bit longer? Are we talking perhaps even about an extension between Garrett Crochet and the White Sox? And I saw the report, same as you did, earlier this week about Crochet and the negotiations that have gone on with the White Sox, and that the extension wasn't really on the table. That's now. I mean, I don't know that that's necessarily later. I filed that away as something that was the latest update on that kind of conversation. I don't know that that's the end-all, be-all stance for either player or team at this point. Anyway, Major League Baseball Trade Rumors did a really good write-up of some of the pitchers, rather, who are making transitions from the bullpen into the rotation this year. Guys like Crochet and Bryce Wilson and, you know, others. But Crochet, I like the way they wrote this up, and I like the way they kind of buttoned this up, I suppose. And they qualified his starts at the quarter mark, right, with 25% of the games played. He had 9 starts, 46 and two-thirds innings, a 4.63 earned run average, a 34% strikeout rate, a 5% walk rate, and a 43% ground ball rate. The 9 starts since, more innings, 54 and two-thirds, a way lower earned run average, 1.65, a slightly higher strikeout percentage, 36%, about equal walk percentage, 5%, and a slightly higher ground ball percentage, 45%. And here's the write-up. At the 25% mark of the season, and this jives with what Mark Feinsand wrote earlier too, Crochet sat on a pedestrian earned run average, but an elite strikeout-to-walk profile. His production had been skewed by a series of 3 straight rough outings, 5 runs against the Reds, 7 in Philadelphia, Alec Boehm got him for 2 homers, and another 5 in Minnesota. Those starts still stand as the worst 3 of his season. Crochet hasn't yielded more than 3 runs in a single outing since that time. He's not only maintained his elite strikeout-to-walk profile, but improved upon it, slightly upping his strikeout rate and sustaining his exceptional command. No starter in baseball is striking out hitters at a higher rate than Crochet, and only 12 are limiting their walks more effectively. At last check, Crochet had ace-like rate stats, but pedestrian run prevention numbers overall. They're talking about the first 9 starts. That is no longer the case. MLB Trade Rumors writes, the only question as to whether Crochet is a bona fide number one starter is durability. And I would strike that out. I would edit that, and I would say availability, not durability necessarily. Every pitcher has durability concerns. All of the pieces are there, MLB Trade Rumors continues, but Crochet has never pitched a full season in the rotation. In fact, this year's combined 101 and a third innings not only stand as a career high, they eclipse his combined total of professional innings pitched, right? Where have you heard that before? Majors and minors combined with him, like we just talked about, but are expecting to trade him after contract talks failed to progress. Again, that was the report we'd mentioned. I don't know that that's necessarily ironclad. A new team will have to worry about how Crochet will hold up down the stretch. That's absolutely true. But there's little doubting that he's a front of the rotation talent. We've seen that over and over again all season long. Just this afternoon, and I mean like half an hour ago or so, Ken Rosenthal was on the Fox Sports Channel talking about the latest in the Major League trade deadline, and he kind of summed up the Dodgers' interest in Garrett Crochet or other top-tier starting pitching this way. Here's Ken Rosenthal.
What they always try to do under Andrew Friedman is get the best players possible and then figure out the rest later. What they would like to do is add a starting pitcher because they have questions really with all of their starters in one sense or another. So a guy like Garrett Crochet would be ideal. He has an innings question surrounding him as well, but the way the Dodgers can operate their pitching staff and maneuver different bodies, they can fit him in even if he has to go to the bullpen or pitch in a bulk role in the second half.
So that's Rosenthal kind of summing up what we've been talking about for a few weeks here. It is, you know, I think it's notable when a guy like Ken or some of the other real big national reporters like Jeff Passan or John Heyman really start to put team names and trade targets together. I'm not saying that that means, yeah, Garrett's going to the Dodgers, or that even the White Sox are convinced that they have to trade him in this season. The White Sox have 2 years of control left on both Crochet and Robert, and they are both going to be incredibly valuable and sought-after players when the season ends as we get to the winter, right? And people get together for the winter meetings and the GM meetings, and then, if the past is prologue, they do nothing and sit around and wait for spring training to start in a couple weeks into spring training. Then we finally get trades. But that's Major League Baseball now, I guess. That's the trade market as it exists in the winter. So maybe the extra factor here isn't so much, you know, that the years of control or the being able to wait. It's teams wanting to act, and that might be as much of a market force as anything else when it comes to two trades of Garrett Crochet and Luis Robert Jr., the two best players on this White Sox team. Going back to the Mark Feinsand piece on MLB.com, found it interesting to note the two names, the other two White Sox players on this list. And by no means does this mean that the three players the White Sox are fit to trade are Crochet and these next two. As you know, Chris Getz has said it a couple of times, they're open for business to improve their team for the long haul, and that means trading current assets. Paul DeJong is on this list. I'll read the Feinsand write-up. After a woeful 2023 that saw DeJong bounce between three teams, the 30-year-old has had a resurgent 2024 in Chicago, already hitting 15 home runs, 16 now, 34 RBIs, 36 now, and a 731 OPS. I can't do that math in my head, but it's more than that. DeJong had a solid June, belting seven home runs, eight, with 16 RBI and a 744 OPS for a market light on shortstop options. He could represent a nice upgrade for a contender. And I would add a very quality extra bat for a lot of different lineups, the way Paul DeJong is playing right now. Potential fits the Dodgers and Guardians for Paul DeJong, according to Mark Feinsand. The other player I found very interesting here, and that's Andrew Vaughn, first baseman. Current F4, -0.1. But obviously that has a lot to do with the defensive value he either does or does not bring back at first base. And it was an atrocious first month and a half, maybe even 2 months for Andrew Vaughn. It has been much better since. Here's the write-up. It remains to be seen just how much the White Sox sell. But if Chicago is going to do a major teardown and begin a long-term rebuild, Vaughn could bring back a nice package of prospects. The 26-year-old overcame a poor start to his season, slashing, let's call it a 932 OPS in June, 337 average, 371 on base, 561 slugging, six home runs, 20 driven in 25 games. He's got a $3.25 million salary this season and two more years of club control. Vaughn would be appealing to a number of contenders seeking corner infield help. And I think this is interesting too. The more I've read over the last 2 weeks, the more I've seen Andrew Vaughn's name kind of thrown out there as, hey, what if? You know, it's just not that the White Sox are shopping player X, right? But hey, what if they were? And it's worth noting that Andrew Vaughn was, you know, he's a draft pick of the, Kenny Williams and Rick Hahn era. Chris Getz was obviously around and involved in the White Sox system pretty intimately when he was drafted. However, that was then, and this is now, and the reality is different at this point, too. I would put Vaughn much lower on the list of my expected moves by the White Sox as we get closer and closer to July 30th, but it's interesting. And the reason I bring it up here on the show is that it's quite curious that more and more writers are kind of putting that name out there as a, hey, what if the White Sox made this move? And I think a lot of that is credit to Andrew Vaughn for having a terrific month of June and a good July as well, despite the horrendous start he got off to, and the fact that he played through most of, if not all of June, with that sprained finger on his bottom hand, the left hand. And if you think, oh, it's a sprained finger, Connor, how difficult is that? It's really hard. It's really difficult to grab the bat and keep the hold of it when you're trying to hit 95, 96, and 98. I mean, that is not, DJ talks about a lot. You got injuries to your fingers. That is a brutal thing to deal with. And Vaughn has done it while playing some of the best baseball of his season. Potential fits that Feinsand's got there for Andrew Vaughn, the Mariners and or the Yankees, which is somewhat interesting. The Mariners dealing with some injuries over at first base. And the Yankees the same with Anthony Rizzo, I believe, currently on the injured list and not playing the way we're used to seeing Anthony Rizzo play while in pinstripes with New York. When we come back, we'll go from what the future of the White Sox will be, the near-term names that we'll be talking about as we get closer and closer to the deadline, and we'll talk about some of the minor leaguers. Colson Montgomery, named to the Futures game. We'll hear from him when we come back on the Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.
At Wintrust, our approach...
Colson Montgomery is rated the number one prospect in the White Sox organization according to most, if not every, prospect ranking organization that is out there. The FanGraphs, the MLB Pipelines, the Baseball Prospecti, the Baseball America, the all, you know, the good ones. Everybody who does this, occasionally in a couple of different places, You'll see the name Noah Schultz has jumped to the top of the list, but for the most part, it's Colson Montgomery, and that's despite the fact that Montgomery has gotten off to a bit of a tough start to the season at AAA Charlotte. There have been spurts where he's looked, you know, like the hitter we've seen him to be, like the White Sox have scouted him and expect him to be. There have been moments where he hasn't. Defensively, it's coming along a little bit for the 6'4" Indiana native, who is learning shortstop, or at least, I guess, proving to stay at shortstop here at AA. He's 22 years old, and most expect that this season could be his breakthrough into the bigs. We're going to hear from Colson Montgomery in just a bit here on White Sox Weekly. You're listening to the Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network, and you, by the way, should take advantage of savings all summer long with our summer savings section at the ballpark. Enjoy select lower-level tickets for $15 on all weekday games and $20 on all weekend games. While surprised last, it excludes the Cubs series. To purchase tickets, visit whitesox.com/section. I don't think Colson Montgomery will be up before the Cubs series. I think it'll be later in the year if he does come up this season at all. And if you listen to him talk, and you will in just a moment, you can hear his excitement for being named to the Futures game and for his proximity to the bigs. There will still be development to do, and he talked about it. I don't think this is – he spent about 15 minutes talking with White Sox beat reporters, including Scott Merkin, who will join us at 2 o'clock, and had this to say about the honor that it is to be named to the Futures game this year.
It's a great honor, especially with all the great players across the minor leagues that you see that got selected. I mean, it's a lot of high-name guys, so I'm very happy that I was able to do it this year. I've been wanting to do it I wanted to do it last year, but also I was hurt last year, so I wasn't able to do that. And then the first year, understandably, it was my first year, so they kind of just wanted me to just keep my feet going with low A and high A baseball. So it makes sense. But just being able to do it this year, also being in AAA, seeing a lot of good pitching, I'm just excited that I get to do it this year in Arlington.
Have you been to an All-Star game before just as a fan? And what does it mean just to be some sort of part of it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I went to one, and it was when I got drafted. It was in Colorado, so they had us do all the home run derby and then also the All-Star game and stuff. So it's a really cool atmosphere. Everything that they do to put on for that event, it's just really cool. There's just a really good vibe and energy in the air, whichever city you're in during the All-Star game.
Montgomery was asked about the biggest area of his game that has developed this season.
I mean, I would just say the biggest thing is having consistent at-bats and playing consistently every single day. Last year, I didn't really get to do that much. I didn't play as many games. I mean, I've already played way more than I did last year at this time. So I'm happy to be healthy, one. So I would just say I've been consistently working every day. And, I mean, there's a lot of ups and downs in this game. There's a lot of peaks and valleys is what I always talk about. But, I mean, I got a good group around me here to kind of help me just stay consistent and just stay on the right track of being the best player that I can be. But I would just say the biggest thing is just defensively too. Just keep proving that I'm a shortstop, playing with urgency and playing with high energy.
You bring it up there. I mean, obviously folks can go to the stat page and see how things are going offensively in terms of results, but defensively, how would you kind of assess where you are and what sort of things have you been working on in that aspect?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I mean, defensively, like I said, I was just kind of trying to stay urgent. That's the biggest thing is what we kind of talk about is the urgency. Guys in the big leagues, they hit the ball a lot harder at you, and then they also get down the line a lot faster. So if I can just keep doing what I'm doing every single day, just playing with urgency and playing with high energy and playing the best that I can be, I mean, everything's going to work out for itself.
Colson was asked to how close he feels to the bigs. You know, what's his proximity feel like at this point? And ended up answering a question, too, about his appraisal, I guess, of the White Sox young core. Guys like Brooks Baldwin and Edgar Caro just promoted to AAA Charlotte, who he's playing with again, and Brian Ramos, who's been down there for a little while now, playing alongside Colson Montgomery on the left side of that White Sox, or I should say Charlotte Knights infield.
Every single day, I feel like I'm getting closer and closer, you know, just from growing as a player. And also, you have to keep in the mindset of every single day you're getting closer to whenever that is. Also, it's a lot of it and pretty much all of it is out of my control. So pretty much just control what I can control, honestly. But I mean, you think about it all the time here and there, and you see all the stuff that's going on with moves and trades, and especially with everything that's coming up, that you just never know what's going to happen. So it can kind of get distracting of being where your feet are and being how you're supposed to play. So, I mean, my best answer is just every day I feel like I'm getting closer and closer to being the best player that I can be and being a really good big league shortstop.
You saw Brooks and Edgar last night. They joined you in Charlotte, and you had a lot of experience with guys during spring training and from last year. I think it's another thing we've asked you quite a bit, but do you like the core that's being developed here, the young talent for the White Sox?
Oh, yeah, 100%. I mean, I could see it in spring training when I went down to the minor league side and just able to see all these guys work and how they're playing. I mean, all these guys are grinders. And a lot of people feel like they haven't heard these guys, like Brooks and Q. I mean, Q's been a top 100 guy all the time. But, I mean, they're really making a name for themselves this year. And I would like to say Brooks Baldwin is people don't look at him enough. You know, I would say he's one of our best players in our organization, just how he goes about his business and being professional with the things that he does. And he plays the game the right way. I've only played with him one game and I could kind of get the gist of all that stuff. And Q also really young guy. He's awesome. He's a really good person too, more than a baseball player. So, I mean, you can see what these guys do on the field and especially at their first game in AAA, none of the fame, none of the all that talk got to them at all. They just went out and played the game that they love to play.
That's White Sox shortstop prospect Colson Montgomery here on White Sox Weekly. Big thanks to the Sox for putting that together for everybody in the media. When we come back, we'll talk to White Sox director of youth baseball Michael Huff. He is also a Big Ten analyst for college baseball. We got the draft coming up. We're going to talk draft. We'll talk trade deadline. We'll talk about how to get your kids out of the house and playing baseball this summer as well. You got White Sox Weekly on the Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.
Waddle and Sylvie, 2:30 to 6:30, ESPN Chicago.
Welcome back. It's White Sox Weekly. Join us at the ballpark next Sunday, July 14th, for Family Sundays, presented by Coke Zero Sugar. The first 125 kids to enter at Gate 5 will head to a special area to receive autographs from some of their favorite players, plus enjoy family-friendly activities. Kids can run the bases and more. Tickets start at just $10. To learn more and purchase tickets, visit whitesox.com/Sunday. Joining us now on White Sox Weekly, White Sox Director of Youth Baseball, Michael Huff, a frequent guest of the show. I would say one of the best friends of the program and a guy that we like to talk to concerning all things baseball. But as we get closer and closer to the Major League Draft on July 14th, the first round, it becomes particularly fun to talk to a guy who is a professional college baseball analyst. Michael, thanks for the time, my man. How you doing?
I am good, Connor. How was your fourth?
Wonderful. Spent it watching the White Sox and taking in some baseball, watching a bunch of fireworks and keeping the dog heavily sedated because fireworks and dogs do not go well together. This is not a good plan.
I can understand that.
The 18-month-old did fine, unmoved by the fireworks. The dog, high-strung and a lot of sedation.
Ugh. Sorry about that. Usually it's the other way around.
Typically, yes. Unfortunately, we'll make the switch in a couple of years, perhaps. Michael, I'm glad we had a chance to talk today. I find this really interesting time of year because not only are we talking about the prospects that are going to enter each and every system by way of the Major League Draft, but we're also going to have a bunch of prospects that come in via trades if you are, like the White Sox, rumored to be moving players to contenders. But I want to start with the draft of things first. And the way it looks for the White Sox, picking 5 right now, there's a crop of a couple of college hitters, right? Your Charlie Condons, your Travis Bazanas, your Jack Caglione's, and a couple of high school players as well that seem somewhat interesting. I should mention J.J. Weatherholt in that group as well. When you do your work at Big Ten Network, kind of analyzing the college game, what do you look for in college hitters versus high school hitters? What makes one stand out as ready to be drafted versus the other, given the big age difference we've got?
To me, a lot of it comes down to the eye. Are the college guys still chasing sliders, you know, that aren't coming out of a Brody Breck's hands, who will be, you know, a first rounder, the pitcher from Iowa? But are they chasing good pitchers' change-ups? Are they chasing good pitchers' curveballs or sliders? If you're in college I'd like to see that cleaned up a little bit more. I would love to see more walks than strikeouts, even though in college now you have a lot of guys that are swinging for the fences and getting 20, 30 home runs. But to me, that's the biggest difference. A high school kid, if he's hitting to all fields, but he's still chasing those one or two times he's facing a good pitcher, does he have good balance? Does he have good hands? Does he have a good feel for the game? And can we teach him and just get some wheels or some miles under those wheels where he's not chasing as much? But in college, I'm really looking for those kids that have a little bit more discerning plate discipline.
When you look at either college hitters or high school hitters and you say teachability, what do you mean specifically? Is that a mindset? Is that a skill set? Is it athleticism that you want to see possessed by the player? Is it a group of all three?
I mean, again, to some degree, you're spot on, Connor. It's a group of all three. But I want to see a mindset, and I want to see the physical tools. If I'm taking a high school kid, he's got to have tools that is you project 2 or 3 years of good college ball. Again, Big Ten, Pac-10, SEC-type, ACC-type stuff, is he going to continue to develop? So he's got to have the tools. But I need to have a mindset that is not afraid to make some changes. It is not so set in his ways that he only hits to half the field. Again, in high school, you know, I want to see someone, because again, if you're a first rounder in high school, you can probably pull the 85 mile an hour outside fastball if you're a righty to left center field for a home run or a double. I don't want to see that, because that 85 in high school is going to be 95 in the minors and the majors. So for a high school kid, is he using the whole field? And does he have a mindset that he's able to make an adjustment? Or am I talking to the coaches, from the teachers? You know, is this kid teachable where he's not so set in his ways and hearing his one travel team coach in, you know, Georgia or in Kansas or in, you know, Washington State that all he does is look really good in the cage and on the field against high school kids?
That makes me think a little bit of last year's first-round pick, Jacob Gonzalez. I mean, he wasn't a high school draftee, but a four-year starting shortstop essentially at Mississippi. And his entry into the lower levels did not go well last year. Obviously, he played a full college slate, and, you know, there's you got to deal with that. But apparently he made some swing changes in the offseason that the White Sox had kind of worked through him with, and that's gotten him up to Double-A pretty quickly here, too. It's interesting that you point out that adaptability, and here the White Sox have a first-round pick that seems to exemplify exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, and to get to Double-A after he made those changes, more walks and strikeouts, even in professional ball. So to me, that speaks volumes to the scouts that said, hey, might not necessarily be on everyone's board as a first-rounder, but we love the athleticism. We see him in the infield, but clearly with that athleticism, could we slide him into the outfield? That's another thing I think the White Sox really need to be looking at. It's not a position-specific player. I want to see someone them draft this year that's truly more athletic with, because again, you're picking in the top five, with those mindset, hit ability, and tool set.
Well, you know, you bring that up, and I think that whether it's the White Sox or whether it's the Tigers here over the last couple of years, and I know there's another example in here, too, that I'm just absolutely spacing on, but first base first players have gone in this first round. I'm thinking of Spencer Torkelson and Andrew Vaughn. Vaughn with the 2 months of struggle here, and obviously a great June for the White Sox heading into July, no doubt about that. But that kind of profile has seemingly altered the approach for teams when it comes to scouting a first base only guy, and there may be two of them in this draft that'll go in the top five in both Charlie Condon and Jack Caglione.
Yes, but both of those guys, Vaughn and Torkelson, were so superior hitting-wise, it's hard to pass on someone that puts those types of number up, just like you said about Condon and Caglione. Can those two make adjustments, hit to all fields? I think we've seen that in Condon at times with Jack, but I think that's where those guys may have had their struggles, and I think that's where I like Vaughn more than Torkelson, because I felt Vaughn used the whole field more in his Pac-10 days than Torkelson did. But you're right. I mean, both of them have not so. I mean, the, both of them have struggled and struggled only in compared to the expectations when you're a top five rounder or the number one pick in the overall draft.
Given the state, talk with Michael Huff, director of youth baseball and Big Ten analyst on the Big Ten Network. Where else would you do your Big Ten analyst work? I'm thinking about, you know, this top five, right? And the state of the White Sox as an organization and as a farm system. I think I'm with many when I say I expect and would prefer a position player at number five for the Sox. However,
add one more to that. Add
yeah,
one more
okay.
To
so
that.
That's kind of. But there are two guys: Hagen Smith and oh gosh, the kid out of wherever, Chase Burns. Thanks,
Chase Burns from Wake Forest. Yeah, the righty.
Really, really good pitchers, and the White Sox have a bunch of them. But if you had to, for a moment, can you do the devil's advocate argument for either one of these players against the hitters that'll be there at five, or is it too much of a reach?
No. It's not too much of a reach. I mean, I would put Hagen Smith maybe just a little ahead of Chase Burns, partly because the lefty versus a righty. But, you know, we know in today's game, you don't need five starting pitchers. You kind of need seven. And, you know, again, let's go back to that great movie Moneyball that talked about, oh, let's use, you know, sabermetrics and let's find these tweener players. And Oakland has this. Well, people forget that Oakland had Mark Mulder and Tim Hudson and Barry Zito, like three pitchers that all potentially were Cy Young winners and all went and signed huge contracts when they were free agents. So you can never have enough pitching. And so to take someone like a Hagen Smith that has been so dominant at Arkansas, you know, it's one of those things. You know, if it's a first baseman like Caglione, it's still available, or a Hagen Smith. I mean, it's like, okay, we're kind of in pretty good shape at first, and we could probably plug some people into first. But we're also pretty good with pitching in the minors. But those two guys are so good. It is. It's going to be a tough one to pass on them and go for a Weatherholt or go for a Braden Montgomery, the outfielder from Texas A&M, because those guys are position players, and those guys can play multiple positions, and those guys are also incredible hitters and incredible athletes.
When we talk about the state of the system, I can't help but wonder if you think that there will be an emphasis, or I guess maybe the better way to put it is, do you think that the prospects the White Sox are evaluating, should they trade Crochet all the way down to a guy like, I don't know, Paul DeJong, does that have any bearing on what they're thinking about in the draft? Are those two completely separate exercises?
Yeah, good question, but completely different exercises. You know, DeJong, yes. Chris Getz is talking to everybody about him, but give me someone's 10th best prospect. Fine, give me a top 10 person, because it's Paul DeJong. If it's Garrett Crochet, I need your 1, 2, 5, and 7 prospects. Like, you're getting 4 of the top 10, not 1 in the top 10. But I don't think at this point in this state of the White Sox, say it's the Dodger organization and they have some great outfielders. I don't think you're trying to make that trade, but then because of that, you're not going to go for Braden Montgomery. You know, you're talking to St. Louis, who has great middle infielders. Well, great, but that doesn't mean you don't look at taking a J.J. Weatherholt from West Virginia, because he's a shortstop, second baseman that might trade. I think the process of picking the best player in the draft is separate from the trades. But as we've talked about, and I've heard you talk about it on the show, again, I 100% in agreement with you. Like, these, every player on the White Sox should be available for the right price.
So we asked at the beginning of the show, for everybody listening, you know, are you kind of like spiritually prepared? Is your soul ready for battle here as we get closer and closer to the deadline? I mean, listen, it is a different thing to talk about the rest of this roster and trading any one player versus trading Garrett Crochet and or trading Luis Robert Jr. And I guess my question to you, Michael, is are you ready for this franchise to make those moves? And I guess kind of also, are they independent of one another to you? If you're trading one, if Chris Getz and the White Sox are trading one guy, should they trade the other at this deadline?
Yes and yes. I am prepared for that solely because 3 years from now, I'm going to probably really like who we have. coming up that are young, athletic, good arms, good hitters, good everything. 3 years from now, those guys are free agents. So if you're not prepared right now to make a sizable investment in those guys, which unfortunately we've seen not work out very well with the Moncadas and the Eloy Jimenezes, not that they're not talented and not that they couldn't be MVP candidates, because they both could, but because of the injuries, I don't see the window aligning. And Eric Fetty, I just don't see the window for the White Sox lining up with those two or three names. So, yes, I am prepared, because I know I will be more excited to see what we have coming back and able to look down the road a couple years from now. And, yes, I think Chris is trying to get the best deal that makes the most sense for either or both of those guys.
One of the things that you are – man, it's just – we are at this spot again, and I think for me – for me, just me, it's really difficult to think about the crochet of it all, because here is this number one overall, not overall, number first round draft pick who has developed into everything you could have possibly asked of him to be, without really the top tier prospect profile close to, but not exactly the same as Luis Robert Jr. as he was coming up. And now we are in this spot where, yeah, I mean, it's this change may be necessary for the long term health of the organization. It's a tough place to be.
Oh, yeah. And let's go back to the Chris Sale days.
Yeah.
I mean, how hard was it seeing here is a potential Cy Young Award winner year after year that's going to set every strikeout record for the White Sox as a lefty? And nope, you know what? We're not comfortable enough signing him to a 5-7 year deal and having to give him up. You're in that same boat, you know, all over again with Garrett Crochet, in some ways in a better position because of his affordability and the amount of time that he's still under team control. But I think, you know, I know Chris is thinking that. I know other scouts within the White Sox are thinking it. And I know every true Sox fan understands that it would be really fun for the next couple of years to watch those two still have fun. Luis Robert, like we saw him yesterday, saving a game, running that ball down in deep right center field.
That's a great catch.
Crochet just, you know, setting all these records for, you know, a rookie starting pitcher, lefty or righty. But, you know, where the head takes over from the heart is where you look at both of these guys could easily be here for the next couple of years. But when they're chance to make that big contract comes up, are the White Sox now, again, you should have a lot of young talent, so you should free up a lot of capital. But I think there may be some people within the organization that might be a little gun shy because it's like I said, the unfortunate events with even Luis's injuries, but more Moncada and Eloy's injuries, that, you know, those contracts that look so team friendly were not team friendly because these guys, unfortunately with their injuries, just have not been on the field enough.
Yeah. Michael, we are at peak season for baseball camps in and around the Chicagoland area. They are ranging from east to west and even northern Indiana. But, you know, we spoke a little bit earlier this weekend. This is a kind of a transition period for youth baseball and softball players, too. Tell me about it and tell me what the White Sox youth organization is doing for the travel teams in and around Chicago.
Well, we train a handful of them. Our coaches are asked by some of the organizations around us, mostly in the west and far west suburbs, to train their teams. But we do have travel teams ourselves, only at the high school age. Those tryouts are actually coming up in a couple weeks, and it's pretty exciting where kids sort of age out of the local travel ball. If they're looking for a place to play, you can actually wear a uniform that says Sox on it, which is kind of fun, and get trained by former major leaguers like Jim Medusi, Mike Huff, Dan Pasqua. And we have a great relationship with an AI9 organization based out of Naperville, led by Andrew Brower and Scott Waller, that really handles that 13, 14-year-old level. So we're halfway through the summer, and we still have room for kids for that 5 to 12-year-old, the in-house little leaguer with our summer camps. We're almost at 2,700 kids registered right now, and there's still 5 more weeks of camp. So, you know, the whitesox.com/play, click the summer camps. You can still register your kid, boy or girl. But for those that are, you know, finishing up a travel season or almost finished, that are looking for a place to train next year, I would argue, again, our coaches, our staff is, if not the best, as good as any in Chicago. And I would you know, add to that, that it was another travel organization that had that kid, George Wilco, playing for them, that those folks asked Jim Medusi, our head, who's also our head hitting coach, work with George and helped, obviously, George do well enough his senior year to get drafted by the White Sox. And it's awfully fun seeing things start to click for him these days as well.
Yeah, crazy home run power for George Wilco out in the ACL. I mean, I've seen some footage. That ball goes a long way off a 6'6 frame. I mean, he's just enormous.
Well, and Jim Medusi is 6'6, left-handed too, so it made a lot of sense for these two to work together. But the times that I've met George, again, this monster of a body with this cute little baby face kid, but a great mom and dad, a great demeanor, and again, with us being able to work with him, as we're talking to the Sox scouts, you know, we're able to say yes, not afraid to change, not afraid to listen, not too proud, even though he could be one of those people that walks around that, you know I've been gifted by the big guy upstairs because I'm 6'6 and I can hit the baseball a country mile. But with that mentality, like you were talking about earlier, what are the Sox looking for right now in that first round pick and that second round pick, knowing how high it's going to be in the draft? And it's not just tools and talent. It's a little bit more character. And, you know, hopefully this year with Chris in charge and obviously a different mentality that we see something pretty exciting.
WhiteSox.com/play is the website. He's Michael Huff, and he can promise your son or daughter the same everything that George Wilco got, except for the 6'6". So you can't promise anybody the 6'6". That's up to somebody else. But you guys got all the coaching and all the pointers and all the advice along the way.
Thank you, good sir. Appreciate it.
Anytime, Michael Huff, the director of youth baseball for the Chicago White Sox, with some unique insight there into the White Sox draft process, evaluation process of college baseball players and high school baseball players, and a little bit of personal note about George Wilco, too, one of the White Sox top 30 prospects. We'll hit a break here on White Sox Weekly. Coming up at 2 o'clock, we'll head to Miami. White Sox beat reporter Scott Merkin is stationed there and covering the ballgame today. We'll get the latest from him about the team. He had some tweets about the upcoming outlook for one Garrett Crochet that we will talk about at 2 o'clock. You don't want to miss it. It's the Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.
Sox games, all of them, on the ESPN Chicago app.
Welcome back to White Sox Weekly here on the Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network. I'm Connor McKnight. We are going to be joined by Scott Merkin of MLB.com at 2 o'clock. So just a real quick segment here, and it's kind of good timing, too, because I just got a little thing I wanted to update everybody on. This is, I mean, sure, it's news from a division rival, but at the same time, this is pretty incredible stuff. Jose Miranda, coming into today's ballgame for the Twins, had consecutive hits in 10 straight at-bats. He was 10 for 10 with 10 hits. He just got a hit in his latest at-bat. He is the first MLB player with 11 consecutive at-bats, consecutive hits in at-bats since Dustin Pedroia in 2016. He has reached in 12 straight plate appearances. And according to this research done by David Adler on MLB.com, the longest on record, the longest hit streak is a three-way tie. The Tigers' Walt Drapo, I believe it's Drapo, had 12 straight in 1952. The Red Sox Pinky Higgins in 1938 had hits in 12 straight plate appearances, at bats, I should say. And the Cubs' Johnny Kling in 1902 had hits in 12 straight at-bats. And obviously, you got to go a long ways ago. 52 and 38 and 1902. Miranda became the 14th player in MLB's expansion era since 1961 to get a hit in 10 at-bats in a row. I told you Pedroia did it in 2016. The last, I don't remember Pedroia doing it. I have a blank spot there, I guess. Bernie Williams did it in 2002. I remember the whole deal, because Bernie Williams in 2002 for the Yankees was a big deal. Corey Dickerson in 10 in a row in 2022. Jose Altuve in 2018. Andre Ethier, oh man, some good names on this list, had 10 in a row in 2012. Kevin Youkilis, former White Sox, in 2009. Matt Diaz in 2006, Frank Catalanato, Rangers legend, in 2000, Joe Randa of the Royals in 99, Frank Thomas of the White Sox in 97 with 10, Chris Steins, who was then a Royal and Red. He had 10 at-bats with hits for two different teams. He was traded in between, or rather two different seasons, rather, the Royals then the Reds at the end of 96 and the beginning of 97. Bip Roberts, an old friend of Darren Jackson's, and Ken Singleton with 10 in a row. If nothing else, I'm happy that I get to read those names on this show today, because that's a ton of fun. We'll tell you what we got coming up next on White Sox Weekly in just 10 seconds. We'll pause it here for station identification. Welcome back to White Sox Weekly. I'm Connor McKnight. Yoga enthusiasts, join us at the ballpark next Sunday, July 14, for Yoga Day, presented by Guaranteed Rate. Enjoy pregame yoga on the field and receive a co-branded headband when you purchase a specially priced ticket. To purchase tickets, visit whitesox.com/promos. This is just good timing because joining us here on the show is Scott Merkin of MLB.com, noted yoga enthusiast, an impassioned Diet Coke fan, and a big-time Michigan football guy, all in one. Hi, Mark. How you doing?
I think you covered it all. I think anyone who knows my calm disposition knows that yoga is a huge, huge part of my life. Actually, there's like two yoga places, they're probably a better name for it than places, but that are located right around me. And I always thought about finding like a beginner class to do that, just because it would probably give me a little greater peace of mind. But aside from that, yeah, the Diet Coke and the Michigan football is right on target.
Yeah, we had everything right. We strive for general accuracy here on the show. Merk, you are talking to people who matter as it gets to closer and closer to first pitch for the White Sox and Marlins today. Garrett Crochet, of course, and Yanni Chirinos, the starting pitchers. I was just looking through your Twitter feed. Follow him at Scott Merkin. Why don't you update everybody with what your thoughts were about what Crochet might have on his schedule here up until the All-Star break and what we found out today about his availability as we get closer and closer to the 15th.
Yeah, I had mentioned in my newsletter Friday that I thought, just from talking to people, that this might be a time where he pitched today, and then they, you know, gave him the whole week in terms of always trying to find ways to buy innings for Garrett, and then, you know, brought him back a little bit after the All-Star break, maybe like the fourth or fifth guy in the second half, and that would give him almost, except for, you know, assuming he makes the All-Star game, which I think is a pretty high assumption, and I know nothing about that, but I'm just saying doing 2 + 2 should equal 4 in this case. I thought they might do that, but that would also be about, you know, one start in 2 weeks, so it might be a little much. So Pedro was asked again today, and he said that there's a good chance he comes back one more time before the All-Star break. And, you know, if he pitches today, there's an off day this coming Thursday at home, so he could go that Friday night and probably a short start, and there may be a few of those in the second half if he, you know, remains with the White Sox. So probably a short start, because they really have been focused on if he makes the All-Star team, they want him to be available. They want him to pitch in that game. So if he went Friday and went, you know, whatever, 3 or 4 innings, 50 to 70 pitches, whatever that turns out to be, he would certainly be ready to go 3 days later. It would be right Saturday, Sunday, Monday off, and then back ready to pitch in Texas on Tuesday.
I think one of the things that's impressed me most about the Garrett Crochet experience, such as it is here up to July 6th, 2024, has been the willingness and the ability of the team to listen to the player, not yes. just in terms of the feedback that player is like verbally giving, but also, you know, the biometrics, right? The plugged in stuff, the actual charting of the player's, you know, fatigue and ability and all that kind of stuff. It's pretty crazy to me. And that takes everybody on board, as you know. I wonder if you can speak to what you know about that connection, that symbiosis between those two sides.
Yeah, I'll give you a little example. I was talking to Ethan Katz, the great pitching coach for the White Sox, I think it was about a week ago, and I didn't use this quote in the story, but he was telling me that there was a game where Garrett wasn't pitching, where he was kind of sitting out in the sun, and they said, no, you got to get in there. You know, don't sit out in the sun. And they're that precise on checking everything on his list. You know, it's been a tremendous story. You know, I think it's a tremendous story because, going maybe a little bit off topic, you know, at the end of last year, he spoke to us after, you know, not a very Garrett-like season coming back in the very short time coming back from, you know, the final stages of rehab for Tommy John. And he spoke about how he really wanted to be a starter, and he felt like he had to go after that because he didn't want to someday look back and say, man, what could have been. And he would have been a phenomenal closer on this team, right? If that's where that's the direction they went. But he talked to Chris, talked to Pedro, Chris Getz, of course, and Pedro Raffold. They gave him the opportunity. And he's told me in a couple different interviews that, you know, he never took anything for granted. And that's a huge thing with a guy who's got that much talent. that he put the work in to get to this spot. This is a guy who's immensely talented, but also immensely committed. And he joked about, he never assumed anything. He told me that, you know, when they said, "You're the opening day starter," his first thought was, "Oh, cool, I made the rotation." You know, he wasn't even sure what was going on then. So, and then the Sox deserve credit for, like you said, working with him and not just sticking to some stringent plan where, okay, here's what it's going to be. And then at that point, he's only doing this. And at that point, he's only doing this. I mean, I think there will be a time, you know, assuming he's with the Sox the whole year, where they probably slow him down a little bit because he's already at 101 innings. And I think his career total for innings was 72 or 73 coming into this year. But, I mean, he's showing no signs of slowing down. He's been great, you know, featuring a four-seamer and the cutter for the most part and just, you know, overpowering it. And another thing I can add, which is huge, is he is trusting his stuff. And that's something that Ethan's talked about. That's something that Garrett's talked about. That's something Garrett said he did not do when he was up for the short time at the end of last year, which accounts for, I think it was like 12 strikeouts, 13 walks, and 12 and a third innings, something along that, and that he was kind of afraid of contact. And now, you know, he's throwing pitches that he admits might look hittable, but he trusts his stuff so much that he has no problem going attacking hitters with, you know, he's got four pitches, but he's really, you know, centered in, homed in on the four-seamer and the cutter.
What does the development of Crochet and alongside it, the development of Eric Fetty, two very different cases, you know, the reasons or the way they got to where they are, but the White Sox are a big part of both of those stories. What does that do for the organization as it regards to their either acquisition of more talent, whether it be through the draft or trades or free agency here in the next 6 to 8 months?
In terms of which direction are you talking about?
Their ability to attract and develop, yeah. I guess, both of those things, right? I mean,
I'm not sure if you'd agree about this. I think Crochet would probably be more of that than Fetty, and I'm only saying that because Fetty really put the work in himself last year, right, before he was with any team, where he changed his whole repertoire, rebuilt his confidence, and was the greatest pitcher in the KBO. You know, I mean, won pretty much every award the KBO had. Now, you know, he's done a great job. He showed that translates over. And I think by the Sox signing him to the 2-year, was it $15 million deal, $14 million deal, they showed that they're willing to take a chance on a guy who, you know, was not very good by his own admission when he was with Washington, had a great, tremendous run with the KBO team, and then they took a chance and he's paid off. He's been his, you know, I mean, if you go by war, I think both Garrett and Fetty are two of the top five pitchers in baseball right now in terms of BWAR. So I think in that sense, it's not so much development, but in the sense that the Sox are willing to take a chance on a guy who is not certain, you know, looks like he's going in the right direction, but not certain. But Crochet is definitely a development case from the beginning. You know, I mean, they drafted him, and granted, it was a very strange season in 2000, a very strange existence in 2020. But much like Chris Sale, they drafted him, and 2 months later, he was, you know, throwing 100-mile-an-hour fastballs by hitters in a very short example in the bullpen. So I think it shows it can be done. It shows, you know, I mean, they've had some development ups and downs over the years, like any team in baseball, but that's a prime example, like you said, of a guy who's done it and done it very well. And then Fetty is a guy they gave a chance to show what he had already learned and is taking it to the next level in the major leagues.
Where are things on the trade market? How hot is the stove at this point? I think, you know, we've been taking, you and I have talked in the dugout a couple of times over the last few weeks about, well, mostly nonsense, but also the MLB trade deadline coming up. It feels, and I was honest at the beginning of the show, it feels like kind of we're doing the same show a little bit in that we are waiting, and the names that have been out there for the White Sox are the names that remain out there. But if anything, it would seem that the desire for a guy like Crochet or Robert or Fetty has only increased from other teams because they've been playing so damn well.
First of all, I minored in nonsense at Michigan, so I'm really good talking in that area. But yeah, I heard a little more about maybe more active stuff on Crochet, like maybe a week to 10 days ago. Now, then again, you look at a situation like Dylan Cease, where that was really quiet for, you know, 2 or 3 weeks in spring training, and all of a sudden, you know, one Saturday and Sunday it picked up and he was traded by the following Thursday, I think it was, Wednesday or Thursday. Different situation, though. I mean, obviously, you have the rest of this year with Garrett, you have 2 more years, and I think it's similar to last year, but different because there were guys last year who were going to probably get major, big returns, and they ended up doing, you know, what Rick and Kenny did. and you knew they were going to be traded. You know, you knew by whatever the trade deadline was last year, I think it was August 1st, they were going to be gone to another team. And that brought back a lot of really good young players who the Sox are counting on moving forward. This year, guys like Crochet and Robert, you know, the Sox are listening. Chris Getz has made that clear from the first day. Basically, he took the job, and if not the first day, the first month he took the job, that anyone can be traded off this roster, so he's going to listen to everyone. But I think, you know, there's a very high bar for both those guys, and the question is, are they going to be met? Are they going to be met, especially for a guy like Garrett, who, again, has been, you know, I would say, I don't think it's a stretch, Connor, when you say he might be the best starting pitcher in baseball as we sit here right now and on July, what is today, the 6th? I mean, you know, not saying that it couldn't change. You know, someone might move past him, but I think right now he's the best starting pitcher in baseball. But what is the plan in August and September for him? And what is the plan if you're a contender for the playoffs? Now, obviously, if you get him and use him the right way in the playoffs and everything else, you have him for two more years as a frontline starter, right? So that's the attraction. But you want to get him for this year, too. So there's a lot of caveats in there. And then, you know, there's a lot of veteran guys on the Sox who are solid players who could attract interest. I'm not sure if they're going to get, well, I'm, you know, fairly sure they're not going to get the return that Crochet or Robert will, but, you know, could interest some teams. So there could be a big run going up to that July 30th deadline. I will say the one guy to watch, and I was just talking about this a few minutes ago, is Fetty. Because Fetty's got the rest of this year. Fetty's got another year under control that's, you know, deemed, as starting pitchers go, very affordable, right? And he's probably a two or three in any rotation, the way he's pitching right now. And, you know, gives you six, seven innings pretty much every time he goes out there. So that might be a guy the Sox can, you know, if they look to move him, could be a guy that they really get some return. I would think Kopech would be on that same level with his ability, you know, not necessarily even to be a closer, to work seventh, eighth, or ninth inning for a team.
I've gotten different answers to this question from different folks over the last couple of weeks, and I want to know where you stand on it. As you talk to people around the league, how much or what kind of leverage do you sense that other teams have on the White Sox if they engage in conversations about Crochet and say, well, hey, we'd like Garrett, but we're only going to give up this much because we don't know how much we can pitch him later on down the stretch? Is that a thing that other teams have over the Sox, for lack of a better term, when it comes to those discussions? Or are the Sox able to step around that by sheer virtue of Garrett Crochet being Garrett Crochet and we have him and you don't?
Yeah, I don't think it's leveraged so much in the fact that they don't have to trade him right now, right, at all. I mean, he's a guy who you could trade in the offseason, but if you don't, then you've got your number one guy in the rotation going into 2025 and 26, assuming you keep him then. You still can, you know, approach him about extensions. But, I mean, that's a pretty good young staff then, right, if he's around with him and Cannon and Thorpe. And, you know, Schultz will probably be up there at some point next year if, you know, things stay healthy and continue going in that right direction. But I don't think there's leverage because they don't have to trade him. You know, so if I think I've equated it, and it's maybe a bad analogy, but it's like if you own a piece of property and you're not really looking to sell it, so that you say, well, I'm going to ask for six times the value of what it is. And then if someone comes in and says, oh, yeah, we're going to meet that price, and you say, well, okay, and, you know, I guess it's time to sell it. Now, obviously, you don't want to equate players to a piece of property, but, you know, I think it's the same thing with Garrett. I think you set the bar really high. And if it's not meant, you don't trade him. You keep him, and you move forward with, you know, an outstanding starting pitcher. And another thing I should add, great guy in the clubhouse, has really kind of emerged as like a focal point of that clubhouse, sort of a leader in that clubhouse. And he kind of, you know, pushes it aside and says, you know, you don't kind of ask to be that. It kind of just happens. But I really think that, you know, watching him in there, he's one of those guys at the forefront of that clubhouse too. So a good guy to have all around. And again, no forced issue that, you know, it won't come down to an hour before the trade deadline on July 30th and Chris saying, well, we got to move, let's take whatever, you know, the best offer is. Yeah. I think if it's not met exactly what they want, then it's not going to happen.
There were reports over the last week that contract extension, I don't know, you characterize them the way that you'd like to. You've got great sources and really understand the system. Petered out, didn't have a lot of common ground, didn't get started. What do you know about where things were at there? Do you sense was this the only conversation that may happen if Crochet's not traded?
Yeah, to be honest, I have not heard much about that one way or the other. Even following up after that, I have not gotten like concrete responses that this is what it was or this is what it wasn't. But And I can't, I would think, just, you know, sitting here now in Florida saying, I would think if he stays, there certainly could be more. I can't imagine that they went to him and, I mean, I guess it's possible that he could say, no, you know, we're going through free agency one way or the other. But I would think, you know, he really likes it here. It's sort of the same situation as Sale, right, where Sale came up 2 months after he was drafted. He signed a team, not team-friendly, but he signed a good extension for both him and the team. And even when I would go to him every spring training and say, you know, Max Scherzer signed for this, Clayton Kershaw signed for this, how do you feel about that? And he'd be like, hey, listen, I knew what I was signing. I'm happy to be here. I'm happy the White Sox gave me this opportunity. This is great by me. Now, I'm not saying Garrett's going to follow that same rule of thought, but I think he enjoys his time with the White Sox. He enjoys the opportunity he's been given across the board. He enjoys working with the people here. So I would imagine that they could re-engage him. And, you know, at the worst, they could say no again if that's the case. But I really haven't heard anything to say to put a concrete stamp on that one way or the other.
Merk, last one for you, and I was just kind of reading through this during the break. It's your piece that came out on July 4th, actually, on MLB.com. You talked with Eloy Jimenez about the frustrating run of injuries that he'd had here. I guess for those who haven't read it yet, get on it. Go ahead, click the link and
exactly.
Do your job, right? Give him some clicks. How would you characterize where Eloy is right now, both from an on-field and mental standpoint? Because reading through some of these quotes here, there's some angst, some anger almost, even resentment maybe from Eloy, all of which would be incredibly understandable for a guy who has the talent he does, but right. Can't quite stay on the field the way he'd like to.
I think there's a misconception that the passion isn't there for him in the game, and I think he really enjoys playing baseball. He's really focused on playing baseball, and, you know, he's immensely gifted. I've used immensely twice, I think, in this interview, but he really is a gifted player. I think for anyone, though, let's say you're training for a race, and you're all excited, and you're doing real well, and then 2 weeks in, you hurt yourself, and you're like, okay, you know, I'll get through this. You take a couple weeks off, you come back, start training again. The other 2 weeks go by and you hurt yourself again. It's frustrating at that point, right? So it's tough to work around. And I thought it was very honest. I thought it was a real good, you know, session talk with him. And then he was very honest about everything. He was very honest when I asked him about people characterizing him as injury prone. He didn't really know that. And he took a little bit of umbrage with that and said, you know, he doesn't really care. He's focused on, he knows he's doing the work. He knows he's doing what he has to get to where he has to be, and he believes the numbers are going to be there at the end of the year. I think the biggest thing missing with him, right, is the power. That's, he's shown he can do it. He had 18 last year.
Yeah.
He had 31 his rookie year. But I understand the frustration. I understand the angst. And you know, this is a family guy now, too. This is not, you know, which he wasn't, I don't think, when he started. And, you know, he's married with 5 kids between him and his wife. So it's more than just about him overall. So I get it. I get, and I probably, you know, would say I appreciate that he sat and talked to me for a while in Cleveland. He's probably tired of talking about the topic at this point, right? But I mean, the fact remains is that it's not a value judgment against the guy. It's just that he has been hurt quite a bit, and he feels like he's doing the work that needs to be done, and yet it just keeps happening. So it is, I would say, extraordinarily frustrating him, but certainly not a resignation that this is it. He knows he can be better. He feels he will be better. And he admitted that, you know, there are some times where it's not fun, and that's understandable because if you're hurt, you know, more often, not more often than not, but if you're hurt somewhat frequently over the course of a 5-6 year period, it's going to lose the happiness at some point along the way, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a frustrating thing. Merk, appreciate it so much, man. Go read the article if you haven't, the one on Eloy there. It's a very good one. And have fun the rest of the weekend in Miami, my friend.
It is wonderfully comfortable, like 80, 70. I always complain about the heat. I need to live somewhere where there's just air conditioning year-round, I think.
That's Phoenix, Arizona, but if you step outside, you bake to a crisp. So there's that.
There you go. That's a good point.
All right. Scott Merk at MLB.com. Thanks, man. Follow his work at Scott Merkin on Twitter. 312-332-3776. Still time for a phone call if you want to squeeze one in. But we got a baseball game coming up on the Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network. Send it up here on White Sox Weekly, calling all travel baseball players 15U to 17U. Don't miss your chance to try out for the White Sox Elite Travel Teams run by former MLB player Jim Adusi on July 15th and 16th. White Sox Elite has helped over 100 students pursue their dreams of playing at the collegiate level. For more information, visit whitesox.com/play. We're going to wrap the show. Big thanks to Michael Huff, the director of youth baseball for the White Sox, and to Scott Merkin of MLB.com. Also to Jack McGrath and Kevin Zipak and Brendan Riley. Pre-game show for the White Sox and Marlins. That's next on the Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.